poor fat Tom, who a chapter ago was saying how much he missed his wife, which is the death knell of any minor character.
You idiot, don't say it.
It's pretty much one step up from being one day from retirement, isn't it? The Queen's there, Grandmaster Pycelle, who's putting on some deathbed peas for him. Welcome to episode 7 of Shark Liver Oil's coverage of Game of Thrones by George R.R. Martin. And I'm Matt.
I'm Dave, hello.
This is a very short section of book we're reading today, but it's a very important one.
Yep.
Shall we dive straight into it?
Let's dive head first.
Right, well, the first section, the first chapter we read today is about Ned. He's sort of having one of these little, he has these quite short mini dreams every so often, doesn't he, Ned? And this is another one where he's wandering through the halls of Winterfell and he's remembering this promise again that he's made to Lyanna, his sister, who died. And we don't know what that promise is, but it seems to have been bugging him more and more lately.
I wish I could tell you that I'd noticed this, but I hadn't noticed until you said it then, that there was this kind of promise. I suppose because I've read it, and then it's dropped out of my head because it hasn't been resolved. So yeah. Apparently I'm a very lazy reader, it would seem. but that's really interesting. Like, what could it be? Why? You know, he's clearly a man of great honour, so he's made a promise and he wants to keep it.
Yeah.
But how much of that is, how much of a dead woman's dying wish is shaping the politics of a country 20 years later?
Hmm. His captain of the guard now is Fat Tom, effectively. And it just kind of...
Not an imposing presence.
No, after considering I was there a while back thinking if only Fat Tom was here, I'd be able to manipulate him into letting me stick around and listen in on a conversation. Yeah. He's not exactly he seems a nice bloke, but he's not exactly the sort of tough, steely guy that you would expect to have as your sort of right-hand man.
Yeah,
and I think it just kind of shows how depleted the Stark household is at this point.
Absolutely. If your best man is somebody that a 7-year-old is thinking, I can confidently outwit him, he's not likely to be a tactical mastermind, is he?
No, I suppose not. Ned is woken up in the middle of the night with a summon from the king, who's returned from the hunt. And Ned thinks this is a bit unusual, but I suppose, you know, he's used to the sort of whims of Robert. So he goes to see him, and it turns out that things are looking pretty bad. Robert's actually been gored by a boar while out hunting.
Just when you thought, honestly, just when it was already looking pretty shit for Ned Stark. You know, he's tactical misstep with the king's wife. He's had his leg crushed by a horse. His family's basically at war with one of the other major families in the country, right? But he's all right because the king has got his back and the king is all powerful, except when he's had his stomach run through by a big pig.
It describes the actual wound that the king's got, and
it's horrible, isn't it?
Dreadful, isn't it? Yeah, it goes from his sort of groin to almost the top of his chest, right? So
have you ever been sort of mano a pigo with a wild boar? Because I can't imagine. Because pig, quite frightening, big. If it gets up ahead of speed, I can see how it would crush me. But the idea of a pig as like an offensive beast, you know, like kind of, you know, lion, saber-toothed tiger, pig. It eludes me a little bit. I mean...
Oh, yeah, they're really dangerous, though, boars. Yeah, they can be.
Yeah, I suppose I've always heard it, but I don't know, I have trouble picturing it. You know, because when I think pig, mostly I think bacon sandwich, because I am an indictment of our age. And it's just weird, like, by a pig, not by a bear or something really impressive. You've been killed by a pork chop on legs.
It's interesting that the king can't quite, he doesn't see it as a random sort of act. He sees this as an act of God and a punishment for him ordering Daenerys to be killed. And I mean, that's quite, I mean, it's quite interesting because it gives, it makes him have a change of heart and say to Ned, look, if you can, try and call off whoever's going after her. But also I thought it was quite a good example of how we've seen it before, how people in high positions like this, and doesn't get higher than the king, can't accept the idea of just them being killed off randomly. It has to be, it has to be a greater meaning to it.
Yeah, and there's something in this whole book about that, isn't there? Because there's a lot of time where George Martin spends a lot of time killing off people for no good reason. You know, there are just random easy deaths like Jory Castle last time, and you know, just the kind of thing where you can be as badass as you like, you can be as powerful against the standards of this society as you like, you're probably still going to die. And I tell you what it made me think of, actually. At the moment, as well as reading this, I'm reading, do you know Bring Up the Bodies by Hilary Mantel?
I've read it. I love it. Really good.
Yeah, so I read Wolf Hall and really enjoyed it and finally got around to getting Bring Up the Bodies. And it, if anybody doesn't know, it's basically Henry VIII as seen through the eyes of his most powerful kind of courtier minister, Thomas Cromwell.
Yeah.
And I was just struck all over again by the similarities between Robert and Henry VIII. And Henry VIII is tortured by this idea that God is judging him for having divorced his first wife. He's got this really powerful idea of God as being like kind of fate with a nasty sense of humour, basically.
Yeah.
And you can absolutely see that here as well, where Robert's, you know, Robert and the rest of his life doesn't spend time worrying about what the gods or God or whoever he worships might want when he's making decisions in the small council, or when he's wasting the money of the country, or when he's dealing with his wife or whatever, or his kids. But when he gets gored head to toe by a boar, suddenly God's in the room. And I thought that was really interesting, kind of, even in his paranoid fearfulness, he's really treating kind of supernatural power as a kind of off the peg, you know, consumer item. You know, he's only really going to it for an explanation when he really seriously can't think of anything else. Because you get the impression, to this point in his life, his ability to kill things has been all the God he needed. It's weird how even in what looks like ostensibly this kind of really humble moment, actually, I think he's still being incredibly self-important and incredibly self-absorbed, you know, and concerned with his own power, basically.
So Robert then dismisses everybody who are standing over him. The Queen's there, Grandmaster Pycelle, who's putting on some deathbed peeps for him. No, he's administering aid, obviously.
Obviously.
And I think there's the King's brother Renly there as well. He sends them all out, apart from Ned, and they have this heart to heart. They have this brief discussion about Robert's legacy. Mm. He's basically saying, I know I've not been a very good king. He says he was as bad as the Mad King, and Ned sort of pulls him up on that and says, look, you've not been that bad.
Yeah, I mean, you're dying, so you're allowed a little bit of self-pity, but come on.
Yeah. But so there are two things that Robert basically asks Ned here. One is try and call off the attack on Daenerys. And the other is this, he basically, in Robert's will, he gets Ned to write out, the king gets Ned to write out his will, and in it he names Ned as effectively the regent.
Yeah.
The guy who's going to be in charge until Joffrey's ready to become king.
Joffrey comes of age, yeah.
Yeah, although Ned carefully, he can't bring himself to tell Robert on his deathbed what he knows.
That his son's a bastard, son.
Yeah. But he just quietly changes the wording in the will to say until his heir
becomes of age. He's a sneaky one.
It's quite sophisticated for Ned, that, isn't it? Political.
Quite political, really. Mm. I mean, I understand why the king sends everybody out, but at the same time, is it not a better idea to have everybody in and witness the fact that he's saying this? Instead of being like, Ned, write it down. I'm sure they'll all believe you with absolutely no complications.
I think it's as much about him just wanting to have a, like, just a quiet word with his best friend before he dies, isn't it? More so than his will. But, yeah, in terms of thinking ahead for how difficult it make things for Ned, I suppose it does make it more awkward for him.
Yeah, just a bit.
There's a talk. Once Ned finally leaves Robert, and then Robert says, you know, give me something for the pain and let me die. They have a very quiet discussion outside the room about what happened, and it turns out that Robert's squire, who, surprise surprise, is a Lannister, was made sure that he was roaring drunk for when he approached this animal. Which obviously would have had an effect on his ability to sort of fight it and survive.
Yeah, it's blatant, isn't it? Watching the TV series, I didn't really have the same sense of how blatant it is that the Lannisters are trying to off the king.
Yeah.
You know, like, it could just all have looked like happenstance and so on. But it's so good. His wife hates him. She's sleeping with her brother. She's got her bastard on the throne next. And then she's all, you know, she gets her younger brother or younger cousin or nephew or whatever it is to basically ensure that her husband dies in a horrible way.
Yeah. I mean, it's quite a long shot of a plan, isn't it, that? But I think they may have been trying a few of these things, like the melee and getting him drunk on a hunt.
Yeah.
Just to sort of think, you know, eventually one of them's going to come off. So they're just increasing the likelihood of an accident. When you first look at it, you think, well, sending him out on a hunt and giving him loads of drink, he kind of does that a lot anyway. So how much are you increasing the chances of him getting killed?
I suppose that's true. That is true. Of course, Robert's responsible for his own kind of actions and so on. But the whole point is that he's depressed, isn't he? And this is what we see, you know, he doesn't like the life that he has. So he's not looking out for himself properly either. But still, the Lannisters, bad apples. Damn bad apples.
Yeah, I also think hours before Robert's about to come back and find out this shocking truth, it's a tremendous stroke of good luck for the Lannisters and bad luck for everybody else.
Oh yeah.
Because it's not like the Lannisters knew that he was about to find out and offed him.
Yeah.
It's just that these sort of slow, sort of almost half-hearted attempts to get him killed, one of them's actually worked at the very last minute.
I mean, I know that this is obviously is very dramatic and is played for great portent and should be very well written, very exciting thriller. But you can see this as a comedy, can't you? like you just put the camera somewhere else and have Cersei every night just like being visited by the various minions that she sent off trying to kill her husband, and none of them have worked. So let me get this right: I spend a week winding him up so that he's in a frenzy of testosterone pride to get him into that melee, and then fucking Ned fucking Stark stops him from going right. Go off and see if you can't do something with wine. Can you do wine?
Yeah, I can just see them setting loads of complicated, diabolical sort of attempts to kill him. You know, like pushing a massive rock to the top of a cliff and planning his route so he walks underneath it and then it just landing behind him. Or him just turning around at the last minute. Or there's like, someone's rigged up a big booby trap to throw a knife in one specific direction and he sits down just as it's thrown and he just remains completely oblivious for these attempts that keep failing.
Like it's the Lannisters as Wile E. Coyote, isn't it?
Yeah, it is, yeah, it's just that.
That's amazing. Do you think that Game of Thrones as a TV series would have been, you know, immeasurably improved by the addition of a few more to the soundtrack?
I think it would have been even more popular had those kind of things been involved.
We should write a letter to HBO, shouldn't we? Stisser, are you aware that you've missed the opportunity for the greatest slapstick comedy since Chaplin's The Great Dictator?
Right, okay. So, I mean, we shouldn't be laughing too much. This is a this is the death of an important character.
Death of the character, yes. I'm serious.
But, I mean, he got, he died like he lived, didn't he? And the actual
roaring drunk and wrestling with a pig.
Yeah. The actual boar as well was described as this absolute monster, and he managed to kill it even though he was ripped open. I think Renly says even though he's effectively holding his own entrails in his hands, he still killed the thing, which just shows you the will and the power of the guy.
Yeah.
It's another little window into understanding just how this kind of guy could have become king.
Yeah, and how power works. And how, on the one hand, power, physical power, is everything, and on the other hand, it's not enough.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah.
So Ned now has got a decision to make because the king is about to die, and he needs to make sure that he consolidates whatever power he has. He's got this will, which Robert very specifically says that he is the guy to take over.
Yeah,
and it's what he does with it now. And he gets this, as he's leaving Robert's deathbed, he gets this offer from Renly, Robert's brother, who approaches Ned and says that, what you need to do is get Joffrey and the other two, the other prince and princess, into custody.
Mm.
Make sure you have them in your possession.
Yeah.
Because that's where the power's going to lie now. Get them away from Cersei.
Mm.
And he says within an hour he can have 100 swords Ned's command.
Yeah.
And Ned refuses. He says, I will not dishonour Robert's last hours on earth by shedding blood in his halls and dragging frightened children from their beds. Ned wants to do this right. What's your read on that?
Do it. I mean, so on the one hand, of course, this is enormously admirable, and this is how I think this is the right thing for Ned to do. But, bloody hell, it's not as if the rest of this political setup has shown itself to be terribly concerned with justice. And it's not like there's some kind of independent, judiciary or, kind of Santa Claus figure that can turn up and say, actually, all of you people are wrong and the good guy is right. It's not Hollywood. Yeah. So what is it? Who on earth is he planning to appeal to using this piece of paper? Yes, absolutely. Yeah. Yes. If this is the world you live in, get 100 swords, get 500 swords.
Yeah.
He's almost a man who's too good for the world in which he finds himself at this point. It does make me wonder how on earth he maintained power over the sort of unruly lords of the North for so long.
Yeah.
If he doesn't have that kind of ruthless streak in him.
Yeah. He feels this is a decision that he sort of is on the edge with.
Yeah.
He just decides not to. Because even as he's walking away, he's wondering whether he's made a mistake.
Yeah.
And maybe part of it is deciding who to trust as well. Because Renly can stick these 100 swords at his command, but they're still Renly's guys. And, how much does he trust the king's brother? In fact, he's got to trust someone. And in the end, he trusts Littlefinger.
Yeah.
Because he brings Littlefinger to his chamber and says, eventually, it takes a while, but effectively asks Littlefinger to buy the city watch to make sure that they are going to come down on the side of the Starks when it comes down to choosing between the Lannisters and the Starks. Before he actually makes that request, Littlefinger has an offer of his own, which is basically, look, put Joffrey on the throne.
Yeah,
you'll have 3 years to. Let's roll that back. Actually, Ned's plan now. He's not going to rule for a long time. What he wants to do is remove Joffrey and the Lannisters, send word to Storm's End, send word to Dragonstone, which is where Robert's eldest brother lives, Stannis, to get him to come over and become king, because he's the next in line of succession once you remove Joffrey. Now, Littlefinger says that was a tremendously bad idea because it's going to create a massive war. Obviously, the Lannisters won't stand for it, and Stannis is the kind of guy we hear about. We've heard a couple of things about him, and Littlefinger's obviously convinced that Stannis is the kind of guy who doesn't let grudges go easily in the same way that Robert did.
Yeah.
So it's going to be a massive civil war if he does that.
Yeah.
Littlefinger's alternative is he says, look, what you need to do, put Joffrey on the throne. You've got 3 years then to work on him and mould him into a better king.
Yeah.
And, you know, if in those 3 years it's obvious that he's going to be a psychopath, we can always quietly remove him. And
yeah, that definitely seems to be how power works in Westeros. Just quietly get rid of him, piece of cake.
Yeah, and I mean, this plan, for whatever merits it has, I mean, you're kind of selling it to, you know your audience. never going to go for this, is it?
No, absolutely. And although Ned, there's clearly something wrong with Ned's mind in that he's turned down Renly, who at the very least has not shown himself to be a smarmy, conniving, six-faced little bastard in the same way that Littlefinger has. Like, Littlefinger has been, you know, was ranged between openly rude and spectacularly insolent. He's just—he's one of the least trustworthy characters that we've met so far, and it's him that Ned goes to. It's just like, you know, Fox guarding the hen house,
and also
springs irresistibly to mind.
Also, I mean, Ned isn't, I suppose, he isn't really throwing his lot in with Littlefinger in the same way that he isn't with Renly, because he's not taking Littlefinger's plan. He's saying, no, I'm not doing that either.
Yeah.
But he is still asking him to do something. And also, he knows the character of Littlefinger is this kind of sly, and he's got this power issue, hasn't he, Littlefinger?
Yeah.
And he doesn't, and he's got this sort of, he must know, Ned, that Littlefinger doesn't like him. He's made it quite clear.
Yeah.
And knowing those two things about that character, to say, I want you to help me, and you're going to do it on my terms.
And you're going to do it secretly. Like, you're giving him phenomenal power, aren't you? You know, because this is a conspiracy. And in a conspiracy, surely you have to trust your conspirators.
Yeah.
But, or you could go to Littlefinger, you know. He's a nice chap.
Yeah. So Littlefinger says, you know, he's going to do it. He'll pay. He'll, you know, for the cost of about 3,000, whatever it is. What is it? 3,000 gold pieces.
Yeah.
The City Watch will side with Ned and the Starks.
Yeah.
It's interesting. Just going back to the Littlefinger suggestion about putting Joffrey on the throne and then getting rid of him.
Yeah.
Littlefinger says, if you put Stannis there, the realm will bleed.
Mm.
And Ned says, what you're suggesting is treason. And Littlefinger's response is, only if we lose.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, which kind of sums his character up, doesn't it?
It does, and it's the difference between Ned's approach, which is very idealistic and is looking for kind of an independent standard of right and wrong, and Littlefinger's, which is, you know, the real king is the one who gets crowned and that's the end of it.
Yeah, yeah.
And you have to say, Littlefinger, who's more in keeping with the way this world and these politics seem to work, in it.
Yeah. You can tell he's the guy who's been in the capital for years, can't you?
Yeah. Like, he's the one who knows how it works. And Ned is a man who's been out of his depth since he arrived and is now beginning to flounder. You know, like, he's been, you know, he's just getting... It's hard for me to have any optimism at all about this. You know, you just got this kind of pulling dread about what the consequence of this is going to be. Because surely it can't play out the way that Ned wants it to.
Yeah. We get a break from the King's Landing stuff and we head up to the Wall for a brief bit of time with Jon. Turns out Jon's plan to get Sam into Master Aemon's sort of care, if you like, or become Master Aemon's steward, has worked, because Sam's about to graduate with the rest of them.
to doubtless another inspiring peroration from Sir Alistair Thorne.
Yeah. It also means poor old Chet's been busted down to the dogs now. He's got to go to the kennels and look after them.
Really?
Instead of spending his days in the nice warm tower with the master.
Oh, that's a good way to go about things, John, isn't it?
Yeah, so he's probably not too happy about it. But yeah, so we have this the effectively this ceremony. I keep calling it a graduation. It's the closest thing I can think of to what it is. But they basically take their vows. The brothers, the new brothers of the Night's Watch, and most of them do this in the Sept, which is where the southern members of Westeros worship. And John goes out to what's called a heart tree, which is where the sort of old gods are strongest, I suppose. And that's where they worship their old gods. And Sam tags along as well, because he says that, you know, the seven gods in the south have never really given him much help, so he may as well, you know, make an approach to the guys in the north and see what they can do for him.
It's interesting.
It seems quite a pragmatic approach to religion.
It is. That's quite interesting, isn't it, really? But of course, I mean, what this looks like to me is like Sam having found in John, who is named after the North, basically, Jon Snow. He has, having found in John somebody that perhaps the first person in his life who will stick up for him and will actually see him as valuable and will try and, you know, make something of him. You know, he wants to identify closer with that kind of northern thing and these older gods. So it's about identity, isn't it? It's about, in a way, it's choosing a new name for himself. Not only has he gone into the Night's Watch, but he wants to go into the Night's Watch on the basis of, you know, a total severing of everything that he thought he was back in the South.
So in a way,
it's quite touching. But this whole thing about the you know, there's seven gods in the south. No, what is it? Seven gods in the south and just an unnumbered load of gods in the north who are older.
The seven in the south that are named after seven specific. So you think you've got things like there's the stranger and the mother and the father.
Right.
You know, and there's, so you got seven there,
yeah.
And then the north is just this sort of loose collection of old gods. So I don't think there I don't think any are actually. It's not like they pray to specific gods in the north. It's just there's just this collection of the old gods. I don't think any is particularly singled out.
Yeah,
at least not yet.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, I suppose we haven't got any more data to go on really here, have we? But this is really interesting to me, like, because, you know, the kind of the religion that's chosen by people or by a nation or which is prominent in a culture or whatever tells you a lot about how that culture works and about what they value. And so I'm actually quite interested in this, how we've arrived at a place where People think of the kingdom or the seven kingdoms as being one, whilst having kind of religious pluralism, because that's happened almost nowhere else. We've nothing else to go on, but that's just a little flag in the back of my head. I'm interested to see how that where that came from and what significant that comes to have.
Yeah. Now, when we talked last time about the Night's Watch members being assigned roles. So you're either a ranger, a builder, or a steward.
Yeah.
And pretty much everyone ends up where they expect, apart from John, who obviously expects to be a ranger.
Because he's badass.
And ends up becoming a steward. And he's obviously furious.
Make me a sandwich!
And, I mean, he's furious to the point that he starts whining about it to his friends.
Yeah.
And Darian, who's the singer who got sent to the wall, if you remember, he got sent there for rape. And his story was that he was, like, he got into this bedroom of a highborn woman who sort of invited him in.
Yeah.
And then when she got caught, she said he'd raped her. And obviously, he was just packed off without any further question.
Yeah.
And when John's moaning about this not being fair, he says, sort of, he reminds him of what happened to him, and he's obviously very adamant still that he had done nothing wrong and he's been sent up to the wall on the basically of the whim of his lord who was down there.
Yeah. And And I love this because for all that we've seen John kind of growing into a sort of noble leadership kind of aspect, he's still a kid and he whines like a kid. And of all the places in Westeros where that's just preposterous. You know, it's like first world problems, isn't it? It's like, sorry, fair? You want to talk about fair? Where were you born and where was I born? Do you know what I mean? Like, it goes even back before whatever ended them up at the wall. It goes back to lowborn, highborn, and the fact that there's no bargaining against it. There's no dealing with it. It's just tough shit.
Yeah. And there's also something else going on here with what this decision means, because John immediately thinks Ser Alistair has found some way to screw him over.
Yeah.
And this is the final bit of revenge from Ser Alistair.
Yeah.
To pack John off to the Stewards.
Yeah.
But, I mean, if he takes a step back and thinks about it, the Night's Watch is a complete meritocracy, and they'd be mad to put someone who's as skilled a fighter as John just as a, you know, your average cook.
Yeah.
And when it turns out that he's to be the personal steward of the Lord Commander, Sam points out, look, this isn't just you becoming a steward, you're actually being groomed for command. Like the way that before Sam was cast off from his family as the eldest son, he was present at all his father's meetings and things like that.
Yeah.
Because he was getting him ready to become the Lord. And this is what they're doing here.
Yeah.
Which is quite an interesting development as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's two things here, isn't there? First of all, Sam clearly knows a lot more about politics as a result of sitting in those meetings than John does.
Yeah.
So John's kind of to the manor born, but he doesn't know the first thing about politics, whereas Sam, it would seem, is a lot smarter that way than he might appear.
Yeah.
And the other thing I was going to say was in the TV series, I was much more with John. I was much more worried that Ser Alistair had totally screwed him over. Because, you know, they set it up and there's a shot of whatever his name is he plays, Ser Alistair, being like, you know, kind of looking smug and kind of, you know, I've screwed you over sort of look. So I didn't really think in the TV series that they'd be crazy to leave somebody like John in the kitchens. But in the book, it's much clearer. In the book, we've had a lot more of, we are declining, winter is coming and the wall is not strong, you know, and all of this kind of thing. Never mind, you know, even before we get to the White Walkers, it's still frightening. So in this, it was a lot more, there was a lot less jeopardy in that moment, I suppose, in the book. And again, it's because it's about politics. It's not a high school drama. Do you know what I mean?
Exactly.
It's about politics. So again, I like that George Martin didn't take the easy way there.
So John and Sam and a few others head out to this heart tree, which is just beyond the wall. It's quite close to the wall, so it's still relatively safe. They expect.
Yeah.
But it's out beyond the wall. And while they're there saying the words, Ghost comes running out of the forest with a severed hand. And this is where we leave it. And it's sort of like, there's every chapter with John, we're talking, he thinks about his uncle who's disappeared. And then this dire wolf comes out of the forest with a severed hand.
Isn't it? Do you know what, actually, my wife is reading this at the moment, sort of along with us, and so she just reached this point, and when she reached it, there was this kind of like, this like cry of frustration. It was like, don't leave it with just a hand, and then you're going somewhere else? What? And I sympathise with that very much, because it's a great cliffhanger, but it is like, no, come on, whose hand? From where?
Yeah, I find this constantly in this book and in the series. You really get into a chapter and then you turn the page and it's like you're flying over to some other part of Westeros. And you're sort of almost tempted to scramble along
to get to the next bit, just to work out
when you get back there. And sometimes it's like five or six chapters before you're going to go back. You're thinking, oh, for goodness sake.
But it has to be said that unlike other books where I do that, like I... if you ever read Tom Clancy novels, I find myself doing that a lot because there's whole chunks of the plot that I just don't care about. So I just end up skipping half the book. Whereas, at least with this, if I commit to the first couple of sentences of the next chapter, I'm going to be hooked back into that story. All the stories are really, really interesting. But you're right. Like, you can't leave it with a direwolf dropping a hand at somebody's foot and then we're going to go and be in flipping King's Landing again. No, I refuse.
Right, well, refuse all you like, but we're going back there. To King's Landing. I said it was short. This is actually the final chapter we're doing today, because the way the series breaks the book down is a little uneven because it moves some aspects of it around. So we're obviously just concentrating on the book, but doing it to the same sort of in the same schedule as the series, if you like, or the same structure as the series.
Yeah.
Which means we get these sort of weird, anomalies where we have sometimes large chunks of the book to read and sometimes quite short.
Yeah.
Anyway, we're back down in King's Landing with Ned, and dawn has broken. So he's waited till dawn to move.
Mm.
And he calls the small council together. And we think, right, this is it. This is where the big sort of play for power happens. Mm. He sees that the Hound is practicing in the yard, so it's quite clear that the Lannisters and Cersei haven't left.
Yeah,
which is his first sort of the first moment where he thinks, well, that isn't perfect. He's not even gotten out of bed, and already things aren't going to plan.
It's not great, is it? This incredibly powerful group who I tried to banish from the city, still here.
Yeah.
Oh.
So the bells start ringing, which mean the king has now died.
Mm.
And it's quite sad. It says that with Ned, something died within him when he hears that. Because with all this that we talk about with the politics and the power and things like that, at the heart of it is just these two very, very close friends, and one of them dying now and leaving the other to sort of pick up the pieces.
Yeah.
And there's, I mean, it's like you've said this a few times, there's this whole relationship between the king and Ned is always tinged with this melancholy of how things they feel that things were so great when they were actually winning the throne together.
Yeah.
And that now it's just, there's a lot of sadness around it.
Yeah, and this is there's too much tension in this because you don't know how it's going to play out for it to feel truly melancholy. But it's there, and it's just this really riptide, this undertow in the whole kind of what in other books and in other TV series and films, whatever, would be like a full-blooded gallop of plot and tension and stuff. But again, George Martin's a genius, and he's put underneath it this whole pull of a man losing his best friend and seeing in a way the final death of everything he risked his life for as a young man. And in a sense, I mean, I don't know, but what do you think about this? Is he just lost momentum here, Ned? Do you reckon that sort of that's what causes him to make dumb decisions like walking away from Renly and then going to Littlefinger? You get a sense that he's kind of lost his oomph, his get up and go.
I think that must be an element of it, mustn't it? That he's struggling to sort of make the right calls here anyway. But when you also drop on in the fact that he's losing his best friend,
yeah,
and he's trying to sort of process that as well.
Yeah.
That must make you even more sluggish in your decision making, which is a lot for Ned to try and work through here.
Absolutely.
This part of the book, there are quite a few parts in the series of books where the G-Man does a really good job of he sets tension. And when something really sort of bad happens, it builds up by there's this course where things could be okay, and and you're sort of bumping along that course, but you get buffeted by things starting to go wrong in the background.
Yeah.
And you're still thinking, it still could be okay, still could be okay, and then bang, it all goes wrong.
Yeah.
And these little things all come together and just completely send you off the rails. And this is pretty much what happens here. We've already said that the Hound's still here, so Cersei's still here.
Mm.
So you immediately think, that isn't good.
Yeah.
And then as Ned makes his way to the small council, it turns out Renly's now fled the castle. So
yeah.
Someone who was ready to be a strong ally is gone. And yeah. Ned again thinks, that's not good. but still, it's not terminal, but it's that doesn't help.
Yeah.
So Ned is summoned to the courtroom while the small council is still sitting. So, I mean, he said, right, you expect Cersei to make a move.
What are they doing summoning him, though? Because he's the regent. Bit of paper. Magic bit of paper. No?
Yeah, but he hasn't really told anyone yet, I suppose, has he? So I think Joffrey hasn't wasted any time, and Cersei hasn't wasted any time in claiming that the sort of power for themselves. This is a good example of Ned maybe being a bit slow to actually.
Oh, do you think?
Make the claim.
It's terrible. You know, I was thinking before, though, actually, with the spectre of King Joffrey raising its head. Do you think the reason that Ned turned down Littlefinger's plan wasn't so much that it was treason, but it was just that it would have required him to take Joffrey into his custody and put up with him all day?
Yeah, like, yeah. Seriously, yeah. Like, and also because...
I don't want anything to do with that kid.
Yeah, and also as much because, not cause it, just because it's treason, because it's the Lannisters, he says to Littlefinger, these are the people who tried to kill... killed members of my household, tried to kill my son, and you want me to put one of them on the throne when they have no entitlement to it.
Yeah.
You couldn't think of a less likely plan for Ned to back, really, could you?
Good idea. I reckon I'll do that. Yeah.
So Ned and what remains of his household turn up in the... Or what remains of his guard turn up in the throne room, flanked by Lannisters, but Ned's happy to... but Ned's happy to see that. Even though there are quite a few Lannister guards there, there are more Gold Cloaks, members of the City Watch, so he feels he's still got the numbers.
Yeah.
he approaches the throne, and it basically there's a discussion that the power shifts from sort of left to right, and you think that Ned's got the upper hand, then you think Cersei has, and as expected, it comes down to which way the Gold Cloak's going to go.
Yeah.
And Ned says, I want no blood spilled, and then tells the commander of the City Watch to take Joffrey into custody, and this is when the real betrayal begins, and the Gold Cloaks attack Ned's men.
Yeah.
And poor Fat Tom, who... I didn't mention this before, but poor Fat Tom, who a chapter ago was saying how much he missed his wife, which is the death knell of any minor character.
You idiot. Don't say it.
It's pretty much one step up from being one day from retirement, isn't it? he's the first to be killed.
Yeah.
Poor Fat Tom. And then the rest of the Starks quickly follow. The next guy who actually can handle himself, who's a guy called Kane, who's popped up once or twice, he's the only one who manages. It looks like he might actually cut his way free until the Hound leaps down from near the throne and practically cuts the poor guy in two. So and it ends with Ned having a knife to his throat. Who's holding the knife? It's Littlefinger, and he says, I told you not to trust me.
And who's surprised? I mean, like, to the clanging lack of shock from absolutely everybody, why the hell do you trust this character with this? Terrible.
Yeah.
Terrible.
Yeah. But I suppose he's got to put trust somewhere.
Yeah, but Renly was right there. He was right there with a bunch of swords. And he, at the very least, you know, has yet to show himself to be totally detestable. Or you could trust little... At this point, as much as I'm pulling for Ned Stark, and as much as I'm sad for his changing fortunes, honestly, you deserve what you get, you idiot.
Yeah, so what do you think he should have done? Put Renly on the throne.
Well, difficult question, isn't it? And I suppose that's the point, is that I don't know. Like, I don't think there was a good way out of it for him. Like, I would stand by... This is in the continuing theme of I would be a steward rather than a ranger. You know, I would have just got out of Dodge. Like, you know, when you had the chance, don't stay overnight. Don't try and sort stuff out. Don't wait for the king to come back. Get on a horse.
Yeah.
Because that's the only way. Like, you've got to... And Ned had it right himself. You know, it was, you know, describing the place as a nest of vipers before he went down there. And he's absolutely correct. That's precisely what it is. He put his hand in a nest of vipers and had a chance four or five times to take it out. And rather than doing that, he sought out the most venomous vipers and tickled them on the belly to piss them off. You know, like, it was just from start to finish, a political clusterfuck. And it's just, you know... Then this is what happens.
With his decision over what to do, I think there's more than a little bit of his daughter in this, of Sansa in this, with insofar as sort of, if in doubt,
stick to the rules. Yeah.
And the rule, because he's not sure what to do, and the rules say that Stannis is the next guy in line. So then he thinks, right, that is the right thing to do.
Yeah.
And then... You know, you think, well, if he uses Renly, is Renly going to accept his older brother coming onto the throne? We don't know a great deal about their relationship, but it doesn't sound like Renly's trying to angle for his brother to get a bit of power.
No, that's true.
But in the same way, I suppose Littlefinger isn't keen on that plan either.
Mm.
It's one of those moments where you just think, oh, he's made the wrong call, and it's a bit of luck, and it's a bit of political mismanagement, isn't it? And it's meant most of his household has been killed.
Yeah, and this is no small mistake. It's just and you've seen it happening for a couple of episodes, couple of chapters now. You've just seen the water start to spiral the plug hole. You know, and this is the kind of... Well, I don't know how bad can it get from here, but this is pretty bad. And I do wonder what's going to happen.
I also think as well, I always think with this kind of thing, I always feel for the minor characters who sort of, someone like Kane or Fat Tom, where you are just relying on how well your boss can play the game here.
Yeah.
And if he gets it wrong, you're going to face the consequences, and there's nothing you can do about it, really.
Yeah.
You know, because all those guys who go into that room with Ned, because of his political decisions, if he doesn't get it right and he doesn't, they're killed because of it, and there's nothing they can do about it.
Which
is, again, it's just another comment on the way that this sort of society works as well, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And you've got this sight of somebody who's imposing enough physically to boss, you know, whole armies, you know, to be a lord with a capital L, but because he's not good at the politics, he's as good as dead. A Song of Ice and Fire kind of in general just seems to me to be a big long list of how easy it is to die. And we see it. It's really sad. And actually, you know, it's that whole thing about Tommen dying and you know, the inevitability of that because of Ned's ineptness in one particular area. I don't think it's so much about Ned being bad as it is about the system being fucked.
Hmm. Yeah. So at the end of this, we're left with, obviously, the horror of just what's happened. And I immediately started to think, right, well, what's the fallout going to be here?
Yeah.
You're thinking of what's going to happen to his children because they're still in the castle.
Yeah.
What's going to happen to Ned for a start?
Yeah.
What's Rob and Caitlin going to do when they find out about what's happened here?
Yeah.
And of course, you know, the sort of wider consequences as well. What does this mean for this war that's on the way? Because it looks like a massive shift in power towards the Lannisters here.
Yeah.
We will find out about all of that in the next section. So if you're reading along with us, you need to go from... Continue to read, obviously. The next chapter is about Arya, so we'll find out what happens to her. And read as far as page 605 in the HarperCollins paperback. It's a long section, and you need to stop reading when you get to a chapter about Eddard. The chapter begins, "The straw on the floor stank of urine," which suggests things don't go particularly well over the next 100 pages for Ned. But yeah, once you get to that point, stop. And part 8 of the podcast will focus on that section of the book.
There we go.
There we go, Dave. That's it. Well, for now.
Oh, that's it. Another
cliffhanger. I'm on tenterhooks.
I am. Yeah. It's a killer. I can't wait for next one.
Okay, as ever, if you've any comments to make on the book, the series, or on the podcast itself, you can send them over to sharkliveroilpodcast@gmail.com. That's sharkliveroilpodcast@gmail.com. Or you can tweet us. We are @sharkliveroil. And we'd be more than happy to hear your comments. We are getting through these very quickly at the moment. So you may find that more casts are coming up before you get the chance to send anything through. And we may have to miss feedback and include it later on. But don't let that put you off. If you've got something to say, you say it. And we'll consider it and tell you what we think.
Yeah.
Make your voice heard. You know what I mean?
I do.
Don't delay like Ned did. You see what happens when that happens. You might not get a chance.
You might not get it. You might be betrayed by a little shit.
Yeah.
Although that's an outside chance, I'll admit.
Never trust the gold cloaks.
This is. I don't think we can extend the metaphor that far, Matt. What gold cloaks? Where?
Yeah. Right. Well, in that case, I think this is time to wrap this up.
Yep.
And until next time, Dave.
Until next time, Matt.
See you later.